Thank you, President John. We actually have two speakers today. As John first started to introduce Jim Hobart. Jim Hobart is a partner of the Public Opinion Strategies and National Political and Public Affairs Research firm, described by the New York Times as the leading Republican polling company in the country. Public Opinion Strategies' political clients include U.S. senators, 60 members of Congress, 6 governors, and numerous state legislatures and elected officials. Part of the team that produced the NBC News and Wall Street Journal poll. Over the past 4 cycles, the polling team has been most competitive in important elections around the country. He received the prestigious Rising Star Award from Campaign and Election Magazine. His firm is involved with independent expenditures for Senate races, congressional races, 2 successful ballot measures, significant research project toward helping Republicans make inroads with female voters. He's a regular appearance on NPR, CNN, and BBC to comment on campaign politics. In addition, he works with numerous Fortune 500 companies and 7 states that I counted. The Fortune 500 companies include Bank of America, Walmart, and Verizon. Our second speaker, and they're going to work as a tag team, is our very own Terry Cooper, who's a Republican opposition research consultant. He's also very involved in nonpartisan involvement, such as this, he's a board member for this nonpartisan senior statesman of Virginia, as well as the campaign for gerrymandering, to eliminate gerrymandering, Virginia 2021. And without further ado, let me open it up to Jim Hobart and Terry Cooper.
Scott. I know that probably a few of you were disappointed, angry, disgruntled, etc., about the election results. And for a couple of Republicans to come to Charlottesville and talk about the 2016 election results is kind of like trying to beard the lion in the lion's den. We are not cheerleading for anything. Think of us as biology lab instructors who are dissecting something and describing to you what we find. But in case any of you were thinking about throwing chairs at us anyway, I want to open this by showing you a couple of fun TV commercials. This is a commercial from Bernie Sanders' campaign.
We'll marry our fortunes together. I've got some real estate here in my bag. Counting the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike, they've all come to look for America. All come to look for America.
Bernie Sanders, and I approve this message.
Do you like that?
Yes.
Now, our next commercial is not from the presidential race. It's on behalf of a fellow by the name of Gerald Daugherty, who was running for re-election as a county commissioner in Travis County, Texas. Travis County, as you may know, is the county that involves Austin. And Austin being both a state capital and the location of a state university, it is, as you can imagine, extremely Democratic. Hillary Clinton won that county with 69%. But Gerald Daugherty, probably on the strength of this commercial, won re-election narrowly with 51.8%.
We've got room to put 2,700 people in our jail, and it costs us about $103 a day.
Gerald really doesn't have any hobbies.
Last year's tax rate was 0.4169. This year, we could take that down to 3838.
So is he always like that?
Yeah, all the time.
Which means that the 3838 is probably going to go somewhere between 3838 and 41.69.
Most people leave their work at the office.
We got three light rail cars. You can put 60 people on each car.
So even if you add two cars, you're talking about maybe 300 people that are affected. There are a million people in this community. I mean, that is 0.01 to the 8th power. If you round it off, it's zero.
All he wants to do is fix things.
So I got this 18-wheeler that's parked in this neighborhood, all over the place, but quite frankly, it's not a code violation.
You know, I think I like helping around the house here.
Please re-elect Gerald. Please.
I think we'll all admit that this was a strange election. Did you ever think you would see a U.S. presidential election possibly influenced by Julian Assange and WikiLeaks? Vladimir Putin? Here's more Vladimir Putin. Do you know who Andy Borowitz is? He's a satirist for the New Yorker magazine. And if you see anything with his name on it, you know it's satire. And this says, Putin appears with Trump in flurry of swing state rallies, infused with a sense of urgency as election day nears. The Trump campaign has enlisted President Vladimir Putin of Russia to appear with the Republican nominee in a dizzying array of swing state rallies over the weekend. Borowitz's latest, which came out yesterday, says, Putin agrees to receive intelligence briefings in Trump's place. President-elect Donald J. Trump said that while he was totally uninterested in receiving the briefings, Russian President Vladimir Putin appeared to be extremely interested. Then this is Alicia Machado, the famous Venezuelan Miss Universe. And, of course, Anthony Weiner. And you may recall that Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate, was asked by Chris Matthews on Hardball to name a foreign leader he respected and was unable to come up with one. Well, Borowitz says here, Gary Johnson says his favorite foreign leader is Obi-Wan Kenobi. Some reactions to the campaign. I heard this a bunch. I just want to take a shower. Then this article, a column, appeared in the Washington Post. This election is so stressful, I've had to double up on my therapy. But you may have seen this obituary that appeared in the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Noland Marianne Alfriend, faced with the prospect of voting for either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, Marianne Nolan of Richmond chose instead to pass into the eternal love of God. What were the results? Trump won the presidency by winning the Electoral College by a margin of 306 to 232. Clinton won the popular vote at last count, and I last counted last Thursday, was 48.2% to 46.3%. And at that time, she had about 2.57 million more votes than Trump. My understanding is that it's now about 2.7 something. Now, the vote margin in the battleground states, in some cases, was quite small. In down-ballot races, Democrats picked up two U.S. Senate seats in Illinois and New Hampshire. The race that was still in contention at that time was Louisiana. They have a runoff. They had it on December 10. The Republican won it. So the margin going into the new Congress is Republicans 52, Democrats 48. In the House, Democrats picked up a net of six seats. Two seats at that time, both in Louisiana, were undecided. Republicans won them both. So the current margin going into the new Congress is going to be 241 Republicans and 194 Democrats. But in the Senate, the 52 votes that the Republicans have is still filibusterable. And in the House, the margin that the Republicans have can be eroded because, as you may know, the majority there can be unruly. We added a net of two governors and now hold more governorships than we have at any point in time since 1922. We gained three legislative chambers and lost four and control 68 of the 99.
All right, well, thank you, Terry, and thank you, Rich, for the kind introduction earlier. To piggyback on something that Terry said at the beginning, we are going to be dissecting this race and talking about the reasons that Hillary lost, the reasons that Donald Trump won. But one thing that I always like to begin with at these types of events is the simple fact that no campaign is as smart as they look when they win, and no campaign is as dumb as they look when they lose. So we will talk about the things that Donald Trump did right, some things that Hillary Clinton could have done better. I think that they both ran very, very professional campaigns. Sometimes things just happen. But first, so how do we get from "you're fired," Donald Trump's famous catchphrase when he was the host of The Apprentice, to hiring him as a country as our president? These are five what I call the keys to the rise of Trump. And when I first put these five slides together, I did it right after the Republican primary election. So you'll see some things about how Donald Trump won the Republican primary, but I think a lot of them really apply to why he was able to win the presidency as well. The first one is what we call an economic hollowing out. What this is the median net worth of families in 2014 dollars. It's a study from the Pew Foundation, a big research foundation in Washington. In 2007, the median net worth was about $138,000. Then obviously we had the Great Recession beginning in 2008. But what we've seen is even though employment is down, even though the stock market is up, the real income for families has not improved. Their net worth is $83,000, and that hasn't moved since 2010. So you have a lot of people who are economically frustrated, who feel the economy is leaving them behind. And even if they've gotten a new job since the Great Recession, a lot of times it's either a job that they don't want, it's a job that doesn't pay as much as their old job used to pay, or maybe they're working 30 hours a week at one job, 20 hours a week at another, just to make ends meet. The next reason, and this is among the most depressing slides, is this loss of faith in institutions. This is data from Gallup that does these types of surveys on a periodic basis. So it's on the left, as you see, the percent of Americans who had quite a lot or great deal of confidence in that institution in 1985, and on the right in 2015. So you see a few groups has actually increased. The military has gone from 61 to 72. Criminal justice system is up. Small business. But then look down at the bottom. Big business from 32 to 21. Newspapers from 35 to 24. Our public schools from 48 to 31. The presidency, 52 to 33. Banks, 23-point decline. Church and organized religion, a 24-point decline. Television news, down 25 points. Even something supposedly supposed to be as neutral as possible, like the Supreme Court, is down 24 points. And then lowest on the list, it's a little obscure there, is Congress, now at just 8% of people who say they have confidence in Congress. And this is echoed by this well-earned anger at Washington. This is, again, data from Pew, Public Trust in Government. 1958, 73% said they put their trust in the government in Washington always or most of the time. Now we're down to 19% and have basically flatlined at that since 2012. But you can just really see the rapid decline. And it didn't start in the 2000s. We bumped up a little bit just after 9/11, but essentially it started going down with Watergate and has never come back up. And then even worse than that is congressional approval. So traditionally, people like to say that the vast majority of Americans start tuning in to elections on Labor Day. So have the Real Clear Politics polling average of congressional job approval right after Labor Day this year, 13%, with 78% disapproving. And I think that people always ask me, they say, well, if Congress has such low approval rating, why do the vast, vast majority of members of Congress continue to get reelected? There's a couple reasons. One is that, yes, the way that the districts are drawn makes it very difficult for Republicans to lose in Republican safe seats and for Democrats to lose in Democratic safe seats. And the vast majority of seats, they are safe. And then the other reason is remember that this is just a generic congressional job approval. For a lot of citizens, they do like their own member of Congress. They just don't like the job that Congress is doing on the whole. Next thing that helped Donald Trump is a 17-candidate Republican field. Throughout the primary and the lead-up to the primary, it was called the most talented field ever, but Trump was on top. And I think the most important figure in the Republican primary, at least, that helped Donald Trump win the Republican primary was Jeb Bush. And the reason for that was Jeb Bush provided a perfect foil for Donald Trump. Jeb Bush was everything that Donald Trump was not. He was the ultimate career politician. He was someone whose dad and brother had both been president. He was, I don't want to use Donald Trump's term for him, of low energy, but he did not quite have the same amount of energy that Donald Trump had. Let's just say that. And it just provided someone for Donald Trump at the beginning to center his attacks on. And a lot of people, it was about a third of the electorate started saying, you know what, Donald Trump is right. We need someone different. We don't need another Bush. And he, by just having that message, he got about 30 to 33% of the Republican primary vote. And that was a 30 to 33% that was never going to go anywhere. A bunch of the Republican campaign managers met at an event at Harvard that they have after the elections every year, and that is one of their big takeaways, is they said, why didn't you go after Donald Trump? Why didn't you go after Donald Trump? They said, because this was a huge field, and we knew he had that 30 to 33% locked in. And so if we couldn't budge him from that, and the field stayed large, there was essentially no way to beat him. So I think that was something that helped Donald Trump as well. And then the last one is just Donald Trump himself. He upended traditional political campaigning. On the left, so what did Trump do? He had large rallies, whereas the rest of the field had small events. I do think that the media perhaps overcovered Trump, especially when they were doing things like just showing the empty podium at his rally. But we also have to remember that networks like CNN are in business to make a profit and to get as many viewers as possible. And when you're faced with a choice of showing Donald Trump at a rally with 5,000 people and you have absolutely no idea what Donald Trump's going to say, or Marco Rubio in a coffee shop with 20 people, we know exactly what he's going to say because he's just going to repeat the same talking points. What makes for better television? The large rally. And that goes along with the fact that he was totally unscripted. No one knew what he was going to say. Sometimes he would say something in the morning and then say something completely different in the afternoon. And quite honestly, he's still doing that as president-elect. You just do not know what he is going to do. Whereas, again, the rest of the field was very reliant on getting back to their message. And as a Republican consultant, that is what we encourage our clients to do and have for years, is stay on message, stay on message. But Donald Trump upended that paradigm a little bit. And he really embraced the media. He was willing to call in to any show at any time. And yes, they let him. But the other thing that people don't talk about as much is other candidates didn't want to call in. They didn't want to be asked these tough questions, whereas Donald Trump was just fine with it. He loved being on television and always has. He made the rules. Other campaigns followed the rules. He did helicopter rides. Other campaigns, we're still doing bus tours. And what this reminds me of is this is Uber, whereas the rest of the field, Trump was Uber, whereas the rest of the field was running taxi cab campaigns. They were saying, wait, taxis always worked in my city. We're going to keep using those taxis. And then Uber came in, and all of a sudden, taxi business was going down, and they were left wondering what they didn't do right. And what they didn't do right is realize that someone new had come into the market and was changing the way that things are been done. And then the one thing that I asked you to remember as we're going through all this is undergirding all of this was voters just desperate for change. And a lot of that is because of the right direction, wrong track numbers. And when you see, this is going back from elections to October 2004. Anytime the right direction number is over about 55%, and this is from a question that we ask on almost all our surveys, which is, would you say that things in the country are going in the right direction, or have they pretty seriously gotten off on the wrong track? In October 2006, 56% wrong track. Democrats won back Congress pretty handedly. 2008, 78% wrong track. Obama won a very resounding victory. Democrats picked up seats in the Senate and in the House. October 2010, 60% wrong track. Republicans picked up 63 seats in Congress. October 12, it got down to 53%. Obama was reelected. October 2014, it was 63%. Republicans took the Senate. October 16, 65%. Donald Trump won the presidency. So there's definitely a real desire for change, and we saw it with other more specific questions as well. So in 2004, we asked, is it time for a person who will bring greater changes or time for a more experienced and tested person? Barack Obama, whose campaign slogan, as we all remember, was hope and change, in that election, just 54% said time for a person who will bring greater changes. 2016, it was even higher. 61%. And this is despite, remember, in the fall of 2008, the economy was literally tanking. The market was falling hundreds of points a day. People were losing their houses. By a lot of macro perspectives, the economy is doing much better today, but still, 61% of voters says it is time for a person who will bring greater changes. And then we said, what if it's someone who will bring major changes to the way government operates, even if it's not possible to predict what the changes may be? So we said, hey, look, here's a change candidate, but we have no idea what they might do. And then we said, on the other side, someone who will bring a steady approach to the way government operates, even if it means fewer changes to how things are now. In September, and this was when Hillary was out to her biggest leads, it was pretty close to even, 49-47. But come election day, 54% of voters wanted someone who would bring major changes, even if the changes would be unpredictable. And then a couple more slides, and I'm going to turn it back over to Terry. So in 2012, there was one attribute that helped President Obama win the election, is that when he would won, the 21% of voters who said the most important candidate quality to them was people who care, or that the candidate cares about people like me. Romney got 18% of that. Obama got 81% of those voters. More, if you wanted someone who shared your values, Romney won. Strong leader, Romney won. Vision for the future, Romney won. But Obama so dominated that cares about people like me question, he won the election. In 2016, we saw something very similar, but it was bring change. 39% of voters said bring change was the candidate quality that mattered most. Trump won those voters 83-14. Right experience, 8 Trump, 90 Clinton. Cares about people like me, 35 Trump, 58 Clinton. Good judgment, 26 Trump, 66 Clinton. But Trump so dominated that change message that he's able to win the presidency.
Now let's turn to the Democratic nominating process. I wonder if we took a quiz, how many of you could remember who the Democratic candidates were? There were 6 of them initially, and they very quickly winnowed down to 2, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders was viewed by the left in very much the same way that Trump supporters viewed him. He was authentic, and he cared about people like them. Hillary, on the other hand, was the candidate of the Democratic establishment. Just as Trump's candidacy was largely implausible, I mean, he had bankruptcies, he flip-flopped, he did all sorts of things that are an opposition researcher's dream. Hillary had a bunch of implausibilities as well. There had been scandal or quasi-scandal following her for more than 30 years. She was horrible at retail politicking. Remember her saying that she and Bill were dead broke upon leaving the presidency? And then she turned around and said that half of Trump's supporters were deplorables. You do not go around criticizing voters. It is a flat rule of politics. You try to attract voters. Hillary was also a corporatist with strong Wall Street ties in the party that's supposed to represent working people. You may remember that in one of their debates, Bernie Sanders looked at Hillary and said, "I never heard of a progressive with a super PAC." And she was a hawk in terms of foreign affairs. When people are war weary, they have gone through war since 9/11. There used to be an old saying that in choosing a presidential nominee, the Republicans, Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. Well, it was just the opposite in 2016. The Republicans fell in love with a very unlikely candidate, Donald Trump. Some Democrats fell in love with Bernie, as that commercial we showed demonstrates. But by and large, they fell in line behind Hillary. The Democratic nominating process was that in order to be the nominee, you had to win a majority of the delegates at the Democratic National Convention. Now, there were 4,000 plus chosen in primaries and caucuses, but there were 716 who were so-called superdelegates, who didn't go through any election process at all. They were party leaders, they were elected officials and others, and many of them had publicly endorsed Clinton from day one. So when Bernie Sanders said the process was rigged, I have to agree with him. Another example of rigging was that Debbie Wasserman Schultz and many of the Democratic National Committee staff were surreptitiously working for Hillary. And that came to light finally in the WikiLeaks. The two candidates presented such a contrast. Sanders had basically two messages. One was a searing indictment of the way things are. But then, as you saw in the America commercial, the other message was a joyous, hopeful ode to the way things can be. As a result, he generated huge rallies with enormous enthusiasm. Clinton, on the other hand, made very few appearances other than before staged and pre-selected audiences. She spent much of her time going to high-dollar fundraisers, at last count, 414 of them, hardly ever appearing before voters. And she criticized Sanders' message as unrealistic. When it's a hope and change election, that is the last term that you want to use. So Bernie had a message, and Hillary had no coherent message of her own. Every now and again, she would come up with, or her campaign would come up with, the so-called woman card. I will be the first woman president. That is a losing message. What politicians who succeed do is say, I'm working hard to win your vote. But when it's a woman card or some other card like that, they're saying, it doesn't matter what I've done or whether I work hard. I have a credential that should get your vote regardless of my competence or my diligence. And that's a losing message. The lack of message was uncovered in one of the WikiLeaks that exposed an email from Clinton's chief strategist, Joel Benenson, back in February 2016. Now, this is 10 months after she entered the campaign. And Benenson wrote campaign chairman John Podesta and said, do we have any sense from her what she believes or wants her core message to be? So, in the final analysis, Hillary won 34 states, including the 9 most populous, and received 16.9 million votes. Sanders won 23 states and received 13.2 million votes. Sanders' problem was that he fared very poorly in states with a large minority population. He comes from Vermont, which is totally white. He had had no experience with black voters at all, and he had very little black support, or Spanish support for that matter, and he conceded before the election.
All right, so despite what Terry and I have just said about all the things Donald Trump was doing right, all the things Hillary Clinton was doing not so right, the vast majority of people, and myself included, expected Hillary Clinton to win come Election Day. And so the question is, how did Trump win? What happened? First is, what are the qualities that Trump had was considered better than Clinton on? Again, back to change, changing business as usual. And then this was all, and this was, the second one was true throughout the campaign. And this is both amazing and shows how devastating Hillary Clinton's ties to Wall Street were for her, not just in the primary, but in the general election as well. Donald Trump is literally someone who has buildings with his name in gold letters on Wall Street. And yet he won dealing with Wall Street by 21 points. Just astounding to for Clinton to be able to give that message up to him. But again, she's someone who knew she was going to run for president, and she was still taking $350,000 from Goldman Sachs to give speeches. So it's a problem she created for herself. Standing up for America, he led by 14 points. Dealing with the economy, 11 points. Protecting America's interest on trade by 10 points. What were Clinton's qualities? Dealing with immigration, they basically fought to a draw. But she was seen as more able to unite the country, being a good commander-in-chief. She won looking out for the middle class by 13 points, making appointments to the Supreme Court by 13, handling foreign policy by 27, dealing with issues of concern to women by 47 points. So she did have some policy and some attributional advantages over Trump. But this is something that we saw in the summer, and this is lines taken directly from speeches that Trump and Clinton were giving and gave us a clue, although not one that we all that readily picked up on, but a clue of just how much Trump's message was resonating. So his message was, this is a moment of crisis for our nation. The attacks on our police and the terrorism in our cities threaten our very way of life. Any politician who does not grasp this danger is not fit to lead our country. On the Hillary side, do not let anyone tell you that our country is weak. We are not. Do not let anyone tell you we don't have what it takes. We do. And most of all, do not believe anyone who says they are the only one who can fix it. That was a direct criticism of Trump's speech at the Republican convention. So when both of those speeches were read to voters, 52% said what Trump said describes how they think very well. Just 36% said it described what Clinton said described what they think very well. So again, this gets back to what Terry was saying about Hillary's problem with finding a message that really resonated with voters. agree or disagree with the following statement. The economic and political systems in the country are stacked against people like me. What this is, that's Bernie Sanders' message right there. That was the core of his message. But among Trump voters, 58% believed that, 37% did not agree with it. Again, this is a message that Trump kind of co-opted once Bernie got out of the race. Among Clinton voters, 41% agreed, 55% disagree. Johnson, 46-52. So it was the Trump voters who were most likely to believe the economic and political systems are stacked against them. So this is from Peter Hart, who's a very prominent Democratic pollster. And this is something he put together after the election. What is the message that Trump voters sent? First thing is on security. We live in a country that cannot secure its borders. The war against terrorism is never ending and it has come ashore. Next thing was an anger with the elite. Journalists mock us. Comedians make fun of us. The rich use us. We're not going to take it anymore. The economy. We're still in debt. Wages are not growing and our standard of living is declining. Student loans are killing us. Obamacare may work for some, but not for us. Understand us. We go to 7-Eleven, not Starbucks. We don't listen to NPR or vacation in Hawaii. We care more about high school sports. We eat at Kentucky Fried Chicken, shop at Walmart, fish and hunt. And then the one thing that Peter didn't include on this that I would add is that a lot of these voters also feel like their religion is under attack, that the importance that the church plays in their lives is something that the elites don't get and that politicians don't get. And I think that people have been having fun with this statement from the Trump campaign that we're going to be able to say Merry Christmas again. And people are saying, well, who was ever not allowed to say Merry Christmas? But it's one of those things where the perception is the reality. And a lot of people feel like this political correctness has taken over and they're not allowed to have the type of freedom of religion that they used to. And I think all those five things are really important to keep in mind in terms of what Trump voters were saying. We want our country back. And that's, we want our country back. What's another way to say that? Make America great again. Then this is another thing. You cannot win on turnout when you have lost on message. The Hillary Clinton campaign placed a lot of emphasis on turnout, and that was what they considered to be their ace in the hole, that they were going to be able to turn out voters at a better rate than Republicans in the Donald Trump campaign were. And that ultimately proved not to be true, not because of the nuts and bolts of campaigning, of door knocking, or whatever that may be. I would say Hillary Clinton either won that or at best Republicans fought her to a draw on that nuts and bolts campaigning. But Donald Trump's message was just so much better that, like Terry mentioned, Republican voters had fallen in love with him and they were going to vote for him no matter what. No matter if anyone called him on the phone, knocked on their door, sent him a Facebook message, whatever, they were getting out to vote for Donald Trump. So even though Obama went into the election with a 53% approval rating, just 44% disapprove, higher than it even was when he was elected and reelected in 2012, and even though the unemployment rate was receding all the way down to 4.9%, had literally been cut in half since Obama's first year in office, on November 8th, Trump wins. Bob Dylan won the Nobel Peace Prize, and Cubs win the World Series. Then the guys there are saying, I know what I see, I just don't believe my eyes. And that is how a whole lot of people, especially in my industry in Washington, felt on the day after Election Day, and I imagine a lot of you might have felt as well. And so a couple things happened. One is that it was finally proven that what was termed the Obama coalition was just that, the Obama coalition. It was specific to him. We had seen it happen in 2010 where those voters didn't quite turn out at the same rates. Same thing happened in 2014. The general thought, and I thought it too, is that in a presidential year, especially with a candidate like Donald Trump, these Obama voters would be back for Hillary and they would be back in numbers similar to what Obama got. But it just didn't happen. In terms of the net performance on the ballot, Hillary dropped 11 points with Asian Americans, 8 points with Hispanics, 7 points with unmarried women, African Americans dropped 7 points and millennials dropped 5 points. So the Obama coalition just did not show up for her. And I promise you, you could find anyone in Washington, and if you told them Donald Trump will do a net 8 points better than Mitt Romney did with it among Hispanics, we all would have looked at you in the eye and said you were crazy. But it's what happened. And that's, again, one of the reasons why it was such a surprise. On the Trump side, these numbers weren't as surprising. We knew that Donald Trump was going to do a lot better than Romney did with non-college whites. That was baked in, 14 points. We knew in the small cities and the rural areas he was going to do better. He did 8 points better. He did 8 points better with evangelical Christians. He did 5 points better with men. And I think that, just to briefly touch on the evangelical point, a lot of people, and especially during the Republican primary, they were saying, how is Donald Trump, someone who said during the primary that he had never asked God for forgiveness, how is he doing well with the evangelicals? And this goes back to what I was saying a little bit earlier. Evangelicals feel like they were losing every issue that they fought on. And at least in Donald Trump, he might not line up with what their minister says, but he at least knows that they at least knew he was someone who was going to go and fight for them. And I think that's why he always did pretty well with that group. A couple of other things happened, and I think that the reason why the election came as such a surprise is the last 2 weeks of the election, two things happened. Look, if we'd had the election the day after the final debate, Hillary Clinton wins. But we had the letter from James Comey, which did have an impact, and then we also had voters who were voting for a third-party candidate really decided not to vote for that candidate. They moved overwhelmingly to Trump. In June of this year, 19% of registered voters were either voting for Gary Johnson, Jill Stein, or saying they were voting for another candidate or not voting at all. It stayed pretty steady. 19, 19, 18, 17, 15, 13, 11. Then they actually get into the voting booths, 5. Something that's pretty common, but it's usually not so high to start with. It's usually like 10, 9, 8, 7. And so what happens is these voters really move to Donald Trump's. And then what we called reluctant Republicans, they really came home with the news of the Comey letter, because what that did is it reminded them of all the things that they really didn't like about Hillary Clinton. And they said, you know what? I might not want to vote for Donald Trump, but I prefer to vote for him rather than vote for Hillary Clinton. This is a fascinating slide and just really shows the way that the country has become divided over the last 8 to 10 years, probably. So on the left is states with the highest percentage of voters with an advanced degree. So D.C. is number one at 28%, Massachusetts 16%, Maryland 16%. So United States average is 10. So Donald Trump won only 5 of those 25 states. He won Kansas, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Maine, Missouri, and Michigan. Actually, that's 6, sorry. Look over on the right. States with the lowest percentage of advanced degrees, Trump won every single solitary one except for Nevada. So this was an election. After 2012, we heard a lot about the gender gap. This election was all about the education gap. Again, this goes back to the Obama coalition not coming out in the way that it did for Hillary. In 2008, Democrats had a 7-point advantage on party ID. 2012, it was 6 points. 2016, it was 4 points. From electoral college perspective, this was an extremely close election. Terry had that slide earlier where I think the 4 most important states were won by 1.2% or less. So a shift like this, it looks like just a 2-point shift, a 3-point shift from 2008, but it makes a really big difference. Presidential vote by party. For all the talk about how Republicans weren't going to vote for Donald Trump and Clinton was going to be able to win Republicans, he actually got a higher percentage among Republicans than she did among Democrats. 90% for Trump. Over on the right there, 89% for Clinton. Trump won 48% of independents to win them by 6. And then here's the big deal, is that the Trump coalition breached the big blue wall. Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Iowa. Every state except for Iowa, Dems had won at least 6 elections in a row in those states. And how did he do it? Among white voters who did not graduate from college, Romney won 25%. No, Romney won them by 25 points. Trump won them by 39. White Catholics, most of those states are pretty heavily Catholic with the exception of Iowa. Romney won those voters by 19. Trump won them by 23. And another really big one, especially in states like Michigan. Romney won union households, so voters with a member of a union in them by, Romney lost by 18 points. Trump only lost by 8 points. Why do you think he hammered so much on the trade issue? Going to bring our jobs back. He was speaking directly to union members when he did that. Presidential vote by region. This is somewhat interesting just because you see how it breaks out. Trump won the South, 53-44. The Mid-Atlantic, Clinton won pretty easily, 54-42. New England, Clinton not surprisingly won by 18 points. But it really shows you where the battlegrounds states are right now. And this is, I think, is where the map is really shifting. This Great Lakes region, Trump won by 4.2 points, 47.4 to 47.2. And then the mountain states, Trump 47.4, Clinton 42.4. So those are the two battlegrounds, the emerging battlegrounds in the United States. And then lastly, the Pacific, Clinton rolled up a huge margin there, 59% to 35. And five reasons Clinton lost, two of them here on this page. She just had too much baggage, whether it was things left over from the Clinton presidency, foreign donations, personal email, Benghazi. What all this did was play into the notion that Clinton was not honest and trustworthy. 61% said that. In fairness, 63% said Trump was not honest and trustworthy too. But at the end of the day, voters in the most important state said they were going to go with the devil they don't know rather than the devil that they do. Another region, and this is very important. This is why I like to say that, look, a lot of times you can do everything that you want in a campaign and do things really right, but it's just tough to win. It's Americans don't like third terms. After Truman lost, after Eisenhower lost, and that was with Eisenhower with a 58% approval. After Johnson, Nixon won. Reagan, George H.W. Bush was the exception at 51%. Really shows you what a bad campaign Michael Dukakis ran. I think in that case, you can't say that it was a bad campaign. Bill Clinton in 2000. Remember, he left office with a 57% job approval and a booming economy, but Al Gore still lost. George W. Bush, of course, not surprisingly, McCain was unable to win, especially when W. Bush's approval rating was just 25%. But Obama, 56% election eve incumbent approval. Still, his successor lost. So I think that is something that was obviously completely out of Hillary's hands that did make it a challenging campaign for her. And then lastly, and again, this gets back to the message. So in the campaign's closing weeks of ads, just 10% of Trump's ads featured Hillary Clinton. 100% of Clinton's ads featured Donald Trump. And I think that, look, I think Terry and I would both agree that going negative for a campaign is not a bad thing. And even if people say they get sick of negative advertising, it's definitely an important part of a campaign. But in the closing week, Donald Trump had a message, make America great again. Hillary Clinton's message was Donald Trump is unfit and dangerous, even for Republicans. Think her final campaign slogan was stronger together. Stronger together is just two words jammed up that sound good. In some of the emails that Terry mentioned, there's literally an email with 100 potential slogans for what Hillary Clinton is going to use. What about this? What about this? What about that? What about that? Donald Trump started out with Make America Great Again. He never left it. He put it on the iconic red hat. And I think the brilliance of it is that it could mean something different to every voter. For some voters, Make America Great Again meant, you know what, I'm sick of illegal immigration and Donald Trump's going to stop that. For other voters, it meant, I'm sick of trade agreements taking jobs away from my country. Donald Trump's going to get rid of that. For other voters, it meant, I'm tired of political correctness. Donald Trump's going to get rid of that. But it could mean whatever people wanted it to mean. Whereas stronger together doesn't really mean anything. So I think that was one of Trump's very big advantages. And now, where do we go from here?
I know a lot of people are quite discouraged and don't see a bright future ahead. I'm an optimist, I do. 93% of Americans have said they want the parties to work together. Now, that's not going to be really easy because both parties are divided at this point in time. The Republican Party is split among the traditional conservatives, establishmentarians, which I would define as elected officials who have been co-opted by the donors and the lobbyists. Reformicons, this is a group that wants to update the Reagan conservative agenda. And Trumpian populists. And the Democratic Party is likewise split among the establishmentarians and the Bernie-crats. It is clear that Trump does not have a mandate. He will not have a honeymoon. As one poll found, 49% of the people who voted for Trump have reservations about voting for him. But I think that there's a possible way forward. And I would, if I were czar for a day, I would make sure that this period of time was a period of time that was conducive to reconciliation, that there were no lines drawn in the sand, that there was no talk about I have a mandate, no talk about what I'm going to do in the first 100 days. And for a separate reason, that's an awful idea, because haste brings out the absolute worst in Congress. I would never mention a conservative agenda. I'd never speak of the using the so-called nuclear option as a way to end filibusters in the Senate. And I would, as to his credit, Trump has already done, said he is in favor of ending these investigations of Clinton, Comey, etc. I would instead announce the governance agenda as correctives on which we can agree, seeking to build unity behind it. I'd stipulate that the process, the way the bills were actually handled on the floor of both chambers, would be open and above board as long as it wasn't abused, with any germane amendment being permitted. And I would first try to build trust in the process. I'd begin with topics, substantive topics, on which nearly everyone agrees major changes needed, even though they may disagree on what those changes ought to be. And I think that candidates for such topics would be creating good jobs, incentivizing businesses to invest and create jobs here as opposed to abroad, ending too big to fail, fixing the Department of Veterans Affairs, ending the carried interest tax break, infrastructure repair and improvement, improving the health insurance system, making college more affordable, and school choice. I would deliberately not bring up immigration early until trust had been established and that the process was going to be considering all points of view.
I think we might actually need to make Terry czar for a day to get that stuff to happen, unfortunately. But that's, I mean, I agree with almost every word of that. So here's a question. What's next for Republicans? I have a framed copy of it's either Newsweek or Time. It's been in my office for so long that I have, and it's right after the 2008 elections, and it's a picture of the Republican elephant, and it says, "Is the GOP dead?" And about 15 months after that cover was published, we won 63 seats in Congress. And I think that is very easy for a party that controls the presidency, the House, Senate, majority of state legislatures, majority of governorships to think, hey, we made it, and now we don't have to worry about what's next. But here's the problem. First of all, voters still aren't wild about the Republican Party. In 2008, after we had a big loss in the presidential election, 38% of voters were positive to us, 44% negative. 2016, after we won the presidential election, controlled both houses of Congress, it's essentially unchanged at 38-42. ask voters, what's the word or short phrase that best describes the Republican Party? Oh, we've got great things like dysfunctional and broken, lagging behind, outdated, good old boys, white men, rich, elite, establishment. Obstructionist won't compromise. The one kind of good word in there is conservative, but for some people, even conservative isn't a good word. So how are we going to change that? Well, so far, pretty much Donald Trump's entire cabinet is an old, rich, white, elite man. And that is just the reality that the party is dealing with. We can't really change that, but we have to understand that is the perception of the party, and that if it remains the perception of the party, we are not going to be in power very long, because one thing that the country is becoming less and less is old and white. Here's some things that we can expect to happen. So live by the phone and pen, die by the phone and pen. Obama did a bunch of things that did not happen that he was just able to do by signing something into law, executive orders. Donald Trump has the ability to do a lot of these things. Over on the right, lift off the general topic areas, trade, immigration, healthcare, energy and climate, tax and financial services. I've been telling people ever since the election that I am out of the business of making predictions about Donald Trump. So I have no idea if he is going to sign all those on the first day, sign none of them. We just have to wait and see, but he certainly has the power to do so. And look, Republicans own the government. There they are, Trump, Ryan, McConnell. Now what do? We caught the car, but now we have to actually legislate. Some potential things that could be done. Supreme Court appointment will be done, but then Obamacare, immigration, tax reform, trade enforcement. The reality is you get one or two bites at the apple of really getting a big policy reform or change enacted, but Congress moves very slowly, and then they get to the point where all of a sudden it's going to be the midterms again and nobody wants to do anything. So, yes, Donald Trump has 4 years, but if he really wants to get some big things done, repealing Obamacare, change immigration policy, tax enforcement, changing our trade agreements, he's going to have to move pretty quickly because you only get so many bites at the apple. And then the other thing is, look, this is not your father's Republican Party. Donald Trump has talked about doing things like opposing trade deals, punishing Wall Street, and rejecting entitlement reforms. Punishing Wall Street, I have some questions about if he actually meant that, given who he's appointed to his cabinet. But the other two, opposing trade deals and entitlement reforms, I could certainly see him sticking to that. Within the mainstream, he does talk about broad tax cuts. He's very pro-Second Amendment. And he wants a muscular military. But then he also wants to crack down on immigration, reject refugees, resist criminal justice reform. So he's able to he's staked out positions that are on all three sides of the party, so to speak. And then again, this is what I was mentioning earlier. The first 2 years are critical. That's when you can get a lot of stuff done. Going more recently, W. Bush knocked out No Child Left Behind, the 2001 tax cuts, the Patriot Acts, the U.S.-Russia nuclear arms deal, and then some free trade agreements either launched or concluded. President Obama was able to do the stimulus package, the Affordable Care Act, Dodd-Frank, the 2010 taxpayer deal, and the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. So there is possibility to get some of this stuff done, but I would also remind you that for both Bush and Obama, they either entered in to the presidency at a time of crisis or a crisis started right after 9 months or 8 months in W. Bush's presidency. You know, God willing, the same will not be true of Donald Trump's presidency. And then turn it back over to Terry.
Where do the Democrats go? Well, the immediate future, by which I mean the 2018 elections, is very daunting for Democrats. For one reason, turnout among Democrats typically declines precipitously in non-presidential years. Also, in 2018, of the 33 seats up, 23 are held by Democrats and 2 by independents, Bernie Sanders and Angus King, who caucus with Democrats. Republicans are defending just 8. Now, of the 23 Democratic seats, 10 are in states that Trump won, whereas only 1 of the 8 Republican seats that they have to defend is in a state Clinton won. On the House side, there are significantly more Democrats congressmen representing districts than Trump won than there are Republican congressmen representing seats, districts that Clinton won. There's a real conflict right now between the various wings of the Democratic Party. You saw it in the challenge to Nancy Pelosi's speakership. You see it in the contest for the chairmanship of the Democratic National Committee. You see it also in Chuck Schumer, the incoming Democratic Senate Minority Leader, voluntarily putting Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders in new leadership positions. But the purge may go on. And one of the scary things, if you're a Democrat, has to be that there's a strong possibility that the corporate incumbent Democrats are going to get primaried by progressives. It is not going to be a case simply of the progressive being on the offensive. The establishment Democrats are going to resist, and they have lots of authority behind them. And another question, what's the future of identity politics? If you go to the Democratic National Committee website, which is www.democrats.org, and you scroll down, you will see the term people. And under people are 17 different groups of what I call hyphenated Americans. For example, African Americans, Americans with disabilities, American Jewish Committee. That is identity politics, where they think that, for example, if you're a Latino, your governing issue must be immigration. And the question is that going to continue? Now, another question about the future is the blue-collar unions. I'm thinking the steel workers, the auto workers, and unions like that. I'm not thinking about teachers or government workers. They're between a rock and a hard place. They have not been getting much in the way of attention from the Democrats, and on the other side, the Republicans have been pushing a bunch of issues like right to work, prevailing wage, that are anathema to the blue-collar unions. So their choice is between being treated as minor royalty by the Democratic candidates and party officials or retaining the allegiance of their members. So, questions?
Thank you very much.
I very much appreciate the objective views that you had. I should point out that we really did try very hard to get a Democratic pollster here to speak as well. I know Terry even leaned on one of his college roommates to try to get his son here. So we tried hard, but I appreciate the fact that both of you gave us objective. This session is podcast, so we will use microphones. And I think we have a question over here. Please.
Yes. First of all, thank you for your presentation. I thought it was very fair and balanced. I particularly liked your presenting a lot of data. A question I have for both of you. The use of polls and the data in them really was called into question, and called into question very seriously for a couple of reasons. Polls are often done via telephone, and people just don't answer the telephone, and the response rate is way down from telephones. The second reason polls came into question, late in the campaign, there was an ABC poll, which turned out to be absolutely ridiculous and absurd and far off from the truth. Next, I published the statistics and have a background on that very carefully and published a lot of internals in the polls. And polls, according to the analysis, were being skewed and manipulated in the end. You got a certain data, and then they were saying. And then finally, what we saw in the end is that after the election was over, nearly every pollster went on television and said they had blown it, they had totally missed it. As pollsters, what do you think you're going to learn from this? Because I, as a voter, and I was a very strong Trump supporter, I will say that, is that I was very discouraged seeing the polls, thinking he will have no chance of winning. And then I saw him win, and I have no faith in the polls now. What are you going to learn from the polls, and what can we expect to be done differently in the future so that the integrity of pollsters and what they do will be much better for us as voters in the future?
Sure. Well, as a pollster, I'll take that first, and then Terry can weigh in. I think that I would say a couple things. First is, if you look at the national polling, so the average of the national polling, the average of the national polling had Clinton winning the election by between 2.5 and 3 points. She's going to end up winning the election by 2.5 points. So the national polls were accurate. Where there were some problems were in Midwestern states, particularly, but in the states that ended up giving Trump the nomination, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Especially Michigan and Wisconsin, no one saw those coming. And so that is certainly something that pollsters are already looking at and are going to continue to look at. I think that right now one of the working theories is, and we don't quite have enough evidence to be 100% sure of it yet, but one of the working theories is that the polls did not do a good enough job of picking up the support of white working class voters. In areas like, for example, if you look at the polling in a place like the Philadelphia media market, where every public poll had Trump doing or Hillary doing, that was more or less correct. The struggles were in places like Scranton, for example, where Trump won margins that no Republican candidate had gotten in years. This is an area where Obama Romney won the Scranton media market by 4 points and Trump won it by 24. Why didn't pollsters see that coming? A couple reasons. One is that when you do a poll, it's usually between 600 to 800 voters in Pennsylvania, and just as a result of the way the population is distributed, more people live in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, so you get a better read there. And so what can we do differently there? Sure, we can do more polling, more online research, more what we call sentiment analysis in some of those smaller markets. I think that is certainly something that we will do going forward. And I think the other error is that there was a lot of error in prognostication. I think that so many people in the media did not think that Donald Trump was going to win that they looked for data that supported that conclusion and focused on that conclusion. For example, if I had told you in 2014 that the Republican candidate was going to be easily winning Iowa, easily winning Ohio, basically tied in North Carolina, basically tied in Florida. And then, again, this is what all the public polls said. And I asked someone in the meeting, I said, do you think that Republican Party, that Republican member has a chance to win? They'd say, oh, yeah, he just needs to pick up one more state, or she needs to pick up one more state. But it wasn't looked at that way. I think the one person who was encouraging people to have more of a realistic read on the election was Nate Silver, who was saying even the last week he was at about 33% chance that Trump would win. Might have gone down by election day to 28 or 29%. But his point was always, and I think this was a correct one, because of the uniqueness of this election, we have to be able to allow for a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of things that can change. There were a lot of undecided voters in polls. There were a lot of third-party voters in polls. So allow for that, and that's what he did in his prognostication. And then I think another challenge is, and quite honestly, this is something that Nate himself has kind of created, is that polls are designed to measure in pounds, but because the media is paying so much attention to them now, they want a poll to be able to measure in ounces. And polls just can't do that. And there's not anything we can do to change that. The margin of error is the margin of error. I can't start doing 5,000-person surveys in Virginia. So I think that's a reality that the media has to face as well. Terry, anything to add?
One item that's just totally non-quantifiable is whether the respondents that were called by the pollsters are telling the truth. There's what is known as the Bradley effect. It doesn't relate to Bill Bradley, but to Tom Bradley, who was the longtime mayor of Los Angeles. In 1982, he received the Democratic nomination for governor of California. He's a black man. And polls always showed him 5 to 8 points ahead. On election day, he lost to George Duke Majan. And there was a feeling, again, not quantifiable, that a lot of people didn't want to be open to the charge of being prejudiced by saying they were going to vote for Duke Majan when that was their plan.
Other questions? Right there.
Thank you. The word I do not understand in the population is change. Obviously, people want to change. Change can be negative, and change can be positive. And that's what I'm going to ask.
I think that a lot of voters, and Trump voters are on the record in newspaper stories saying this, they were even willing to, and this is not all Trump voters, but there was definitely a swath of them, a significant swath, that are willing to just blow it all up. They say, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, essentially. And I think for them, change, even if it's bad change, is better than just keeping on the current course.
So while we're waiting for the next question, I have one. Bill Bishop wrote a book in 2008, The Big Sort, arguing that many of us are moving to folks that are similar to us in education and religion and even perhaps political views. Do you see that having a role in this particular election?
Without a doubt. I mean, Hillary Clinton won 45 of the biggest 50 cities in the country. And I think it played a role, again, in people not being able to see this election coming. Even being a Republican who lives just outside of Washington, I knew very, very few Trump supporters in my social circles. I was having lunch with someone on Monday who went to a wedding in Buffalo a few weeks before the election, and he said that this was a working class community with firefighter and police union members there. He said he was talking to them. They knew he worked in Washington. He said every single one was voting for Trump. And so I think that it plays into this feeling of we're getting left behind, because if you feel like you're getting left behind and ignored by your politicians, and you go to the local diner and the person next to you says it as well, and the person across from you says it too, that it just builds upon itself. Whereas what a lot of people were doing, and again, I include myself in this, we're talking to people and saying things like, Trump's not going to win, right? Oh, yeah, no, he's definitely not going to win. Yeah, Hillary's got this, yeah. And so it just becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy, because more and more people are surrounding themselves with those who share their, I wouldn't say their politics as much as their ideologies and their just general view of the world.
We've got a question back here, and then we'll come up.
Is the Comey letter, would you view that as malicious, or he just got caught in the rock in a hard place?
Can you repeat that, sir? Sorry.
The FBI letter.
So here's my biggest thing with that is, you know how you don't have a Comey letter? Don't nominate someone under investigation by the FBI. I mean, I think that did it come out at a bad time for Hillary? Yes. But, you know, she was under investigation by the FBI. Don't have a private email server, and that never comes out. So I don't. It's just a weird thing to be making an excuse. It's like, to me, it's like getting caught for drunk driving and trying to blame the bartender for giving you the last beer. Like, you know, take some responsibility for what got you into that situation.
Question over here, Gene.
Wait one second. The explanation I heard, and I have no reason to believe or disbelieve it, as to why Comey wrote that letter, is that when he was testifying before the House committee, he promised Congressman Sensenbrenner that that what he had testified to was accurate so far as he knew it at that point in time, and if he learned other information, he would provide it to the committee.
Gene Ecton.
I would like, first of all, to thank Rich DeMong for bringing this wonderful program, and I also thank our speakers. I've heard analysis of this election in Charlottesville and Richmond and Washington, D.C., and yours is by far the better one. Now, we'll add what Kellyanne Conway said was the reason Trump won. And she said that people didn't like Hillary Clinton. They didn't trust her. And that was something Trump could play on. Crooked Hillary, crooked Hillary, because people believed it. The other thing was even more important. Hillary thought she was going to coast. She had it all ready to roll. She even had a fantastic welcoming inaugural type of election event planned when she accepted all of this wonderful acclamation. So Kellyanne Conway told Trump, you say you always win. You always say you are a winner. Don't say that. Say you're the underdog. You need help. Please come out and vote for me. Please come out and work for me. And those two things Kellyanne Conway said was why Trump won.
Do you have a reaction?
Yeah, I think, and Terry touched on this some. Look, Hillary spent all of August after the convention. She made almost no public appearances, and she spent all her time at private fundraisers. And, again, she did not like retail politics. And a reporter that I know told this story all the way back in 2015 in Iowa, relatively small event, probably about this size. But there was a back entrance to get in. And she said after the event, her staff was saying, you know, could you just go out and shake a few hands and take a few pictures? And she said, she went out the back. And I think it's that type of resistance to campaigning. She wanted to become president, or she wanted to be president. She didn't want to have to do the campaigning to actually become president. I didn't phrase that correctly, but yeah, I think that it is very difficult to say that Donald Trump, if not wanting it more, he definitely put in more effort in terms of all the events that he was holding and the rallies and his willingness to appear on television. He was certainly a more accessible candidate.
Frank Luntz is a Republican who specializes in doing focus groups where you get really in-depth views about individual voters. Frank was quoted as saying, there's an intensity of the Trump voter that I haven't seen in my life in politics. These people don't care what Trump says or what people say about Trump. They will follow him to the end of the earth, and they will follow him if he says to oppose other Republican candidates. And an example of that, you remember the Access Hollywood video that was released, and part of it has Trump saying to Billy Bush that he's powerful enough that he could walk up to women and grab them in the crotch. Hallie Jackson of MSNBC reported that the day after that video was released, she went to a Trump rally. And there was a woman there, and by the way, her picture's on the internet, wearing a T-shirt that said, Trump can grab my, with an arrow pointing down.
There's a question over here. Yes, ma'am.
He also said...
Use this microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is it on? He also said
He could shoot somebody and the people would still vote for it.
Yep.
But I have to say, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. Donald Trump didn't. And I think they need to do away with the Electoral College because, yes, so, absolutely.
But that,
yes.
We might have to do a program on
that's
that.
That's for the we'll, January okay. meeting, but and you, I won't be at that
no.
one.
Yeah, do you have person, a question? Do you have a question for the...
The person that wins the popular vote ought to be elected.
Right. So do you have a question for these folks?
No.
Okay. There's a question in the back, and Madison. And you had a question earlier, still?
Yeah.
Okay. So Virginia next. Or Kim. Madison.
Oh, me. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Madison.
Last spring, well, late winter, I went up to a friend of mine who used to be the Republican chair here in the county probably 10, 15 years ago. And I said to him, what are y'all going to do? And he said, Madison, I have absolutely no idea. So now I'm going to ask you again. What are y'all going to do when he won't take daily public, president's daily briefings, when he goes off message, when he does all of the things that which he has done for a year and a half? What are y'all going to do?
Well, this is why I'm glad I'm a private Republican and not a public Republican. You know, I think, I mean, I'll look at it first from just a purely policy standpoint. I think here's a big question is that one of the things that Trump has said that he wants to accomplish is doing literally a $1 trillion infrastructure package, right? And then you have Paul Ryan, who's the Speaker of the House, who has staked his political career on cutting spending. So with that dynamic, something has to give. The question is, what's going to give? And that, I just don't know. I don't think, you know, Donald Trump is obviously someone who has stuck to his guns for the past 18 months. But I think he also is someone who wants to be as seen as a president who can get things done. He loves talking about what a good deal maker he is. So I would like to think that there will be some room for negotiation with him. But quite frankly, when he does the things that he does, I don't see how we can stop him. His argument is going to be like, you tried to stop me for 18 months and then I won. So why am I going to let you stop me now?
Terry, do you want to add to that? Kim.
I'm not his keeper.
Yeah.
Kim.
Thank you both for a very interesting conversation here. My question is there data out there that shows what role racism played in this election?
There is not. I mean, I think it's you're not going to get someone. There's just not a poll question that you can get at to ask that. You know, did Donald Trump do extremely well with people who want to build a wall? Yeah. Did Donald Trump do very well with people who are not as supportive of things like criminal justice reform? Yeah. So that is what it is, but there's nothing that I can say, you know, that played a role.
There's a lot of information to the contrary also. For example, in today's Washington Post, there's an article about how Yuma County, Arizona, which is majority Latino, went for Trump. Yeah. Because the immigration issue was less important to a lot of those voters than the jobs issue.
Yeah, and I think Obama's own press secretary has said that there are probably 3 million voters, at least in the country, who voted for Obama twice and Trump once. So
this will be the last question. Yes, ma'am.
The second question here on the handout was, why did socialist Vermont Bernie Sanders perform so well in the primaries, yet lose the nomination? I would first object to the term capital S socialist. He defined himself as a small d, democratic socialist. And then beyond that, then how did he still lose? We haven't really talked too much about the DNC here.
I thought I did. I think my feeling was that with the superdelegates and the intervention of Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the DNC staff, Sanders was legitimately criticizing the opponents as having rigged the system.
Why call him a socialist, Capital West? There's something misunderstanding. He never said that the government should own and regulate.
Sure, that may have been a typo on our fault for putting it in the brochure. I want to thank both of the speakers for educating us on what took place and giving us some insight into the future. Thank you. Both have done a great job, so thank you.